the much-needed medical supplies. And this is not only the case for EB patients in Iran. You see, one of the many requirements in living with this disease is a special type of bandage. This bandage must be able to help protect the patient's very fragile skin against any pressure that can cause it to blister. At the same time, this bandage must be made of special material so as not to stick to the patient's skin. Otherwise, in order to be changed, it has to be peeled off the EB patient, which can be extremely painful and cause terrible blisters by itself. And this special bandage is made by a Swedish company, a company that refuses to sell its products to Iranian EB patients as it fears being punished due to U.S. enforced sanctions on Iran. There were some heart-rending stories that I heard while visiting the EB home, and the NGO has sent official letters to the company requesting that the required medical supplies be sold to Iranian patients, as you see here. Yet the company's response is that it cannot be done, unfortunately, due to the U.S. economic sanctions in force. Now the question is, what remains is the legality of these sanctions internationally, and what can be done to resolve the issues faced by these patients? So to discuss this situation further, we will be joined shortly by United Nations Special Rapporteur, Dr. Elena Duhan.
Dr. Elena Duhan is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. She is a professor of international law. Her teaching and research concentrate on sanctions and human rights law, international law, and international environmental law. She is the author of more than 150 books and articles on international law. She has over 40 publications which focus on human rights, targeted and comprehensive sanctions, unilateral coercive measures, and freedom of opinion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Duhan. What's your assessment of the effect of U.S. unilateral sanctions on the people of these nations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the use of unilateral sanctions, people usually the whole population of the country is affected quite broadly, especially in the health area. So situation in Iran is not so bad as it's some other countries being under unilateral sanctions in a view of the fact that Iran is producing more than 90% of its medicine domestically. We need to take into account, however, that even when the country is producing the medicine domestically, people which are in need of this medicine may still be affected. Take into account that countries need to import raw materials for the medicine. And unfortunately, with the use of unilateral sanctions, especially the comprehensive unilateral sanctions towards Iran, many producers of raw materials are very much reluctant to sell raw materials to Iran. There are problems with delivery and payment. There is a need to use alternative means for payments and delivery. And therefore, it's very complicated to guarantee necessary quality of raw materials.
Well, you talked about the restrictions and the difficulties. What can be done about this situation?
I received information about this situation a few months ago, and I have drafted a communication to the company and to Sweden, asking for the assistance on that situation. And unfortunately, the responses which I received unofficially were demonstrating the concerns of the company to be subjected to the sanctions of the United States from one side because of getting money from Iran. Secondly, there were concerns about the ways to get payment from Iran and the ways to deliver these bandages from Sweden to Iran. Previous time, that was UNICEF, which directly engaged into negotiations with Sweden, which resulted in the possibility to deliver the year storage of bandages. Unfortunately, the storage will be over around September this year. And now UNICEF is cooperating again with Sweden and the company trying to deliver these bandages to the EB patients. Unfortunately, as I have said, that's an ad hoc solution. After coming back from Iran, I also had a meeting with the ambassador of Sweden, and we discussed the situation, and I pointed out that the ad hoc solution is not a solution for the problem. People shall not leave not knowing whether they will be able to get the bandages tomorrow or in a year or not, and what caused them suffering and naturally deteriorate their quality of life. So I asked them to get engaged with the company and to guarantee the unimpeded procurement of this medicine.
What is it going to take to resolve this once and for all?
So the very first step, what the United Nations did, it established this mandate. So basically that was a response to the use of unilateral sanctions and plus to the humanitarian impact unilateral sanctions do. So as I have mentioned, I tried to raise awareness to show specific evidences of humanitarian impact, because what I often face in my work is when I start to talk to the embassies of the countries in which the companies producing the unique equipment are registered, they say, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize that people are suffering that much and that people are dying. So that was the very first step of the activity of the United Nations. Again, when we are speaking about the short-term solutions, the UN agencies in the countries, and in particular I speak about a number of specialized agencies in Iran, are very actively engaging now to guarantee the delivery of the basic medical goods necessary for the survival of the people. For example, UNICEF in Iran is very actively engaging to procure the bandages to the EB patients and to procure some other necessary medical equipment for people suffering from severe diseases. However, we need to realize that that's ad hoc solutions trying to handle the situation for a very short period for a very limited group of people. Around a month ago, me together with some other special rapporteurs have issued a press release calling for a total lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed over critical infrastructure, medical goods, without any need to get extra licenses. Because today, unfortunately, something what has been announced to be called humanitarian exceptions is not functioning at all. It's necessary to get a license. It's necessary to find a way how to transfer money, how to guarantee the delivery. When we speak about EB patients in Iran, the recent attempt of UNICEF to deliver a little bit more than a year's storage of bandages for EB patients took a year and a half. And today they are trying to engage into delivery of the second delivery. At the same time, I believe that the United Nations shall guarantee that this means all sorts of critical goods are exempted from the use of unilateral sanctions, first of all. In the long-term perspective, I try now to engage with many UN institutions as well as with states and humanitarian actors and scholars to bring attention to the issue of legality. If states will stop to use illegal means, that will mean that we won't need to have the notion what is called humanitarian exception, because sanctions will not be imposed and the states will be able to guarantee the delivery of life-saving medicine.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Dr. Elena Duhani. Now, Iran's EB patients have only a few months' worth of special bandages left. They don't know if and when they can receive the next shipment. Many are too young to even understand what sanctions are, and others can't see why their treatment should have anything to do with politics and sanctions against Iran, which are deemed illegal by international standards. Plus, it's not only EB patients who are suffering as a result of these sanctions. All patients whose required medicine and treatment are not entirely made in Iran are affected by these multifaceted sanctions. Now, this leaves Iran's doctors no choice but to either find a way to get around the sanctions or to tell their patients, sorry, I don't think that you will make it. Isn't it ironic, though, that these sanctions are placed on Iran by the U.S., which claims to be the flag bearer of human rights, when in reality, Washington has one of the worst records of waging wars against various nations, using their government's violation of these same rights as an excuse. And now the war is on. the U.S. government against special needs patients in sanctioned countries. Will the special needs patients win this battle and be able to heal their wounds, or will the U.S. manage to cause them to die in agony? Either way, these innocent patients will be the only victors in this cowardly war. Until next week, when we come to you to shed light on a whole other set of hidden files. Goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
It is not obvious that the war on Palestine is having serious negative repercussions on the Zionist regime's economy, while many political and economic analysts are focused on immediate econometric accept of the unprecedented regional situation, what is beneath the surface in economic terms is far more significant. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "It should be kept in mind. In economics, not everything that counts can be counted. It is well known that the Zionist regime is a subsidized entity without economic backing from NATO regimes led by the US. Israel would have collapsed long ago. American politicians assume that by pressuring Washington-backed dictatorships to recognize apartheid Israel as a legitimate regime, they would trigger organic economic interactions between the Zionist regime, wealthy PGCC regimes, and Western economies. This was the wishful economic goal of the entire normalization process. This wishful thinking was just that, wishful thinking. The reality of the Zionist regime's economic unsustainability as an independent entity is currently in full view. From day one of the current low-intensity regional war, Zionist regime officials had to rely on American financial and military aid. People and businesses fear instability. The more unstable the region is, the less likely that it will attract long-term strategic investment. This also applies to the adversaries of the U.S. Zionist nexus, but they are slowly but surely diversifying their economies away from the declining Western economies. Also, they're not fully reliant on Western handouts to remain afloat." Overall, the Zionist regime is an unprecedented economic situation. More and more taxpayers in Western countries are growing uneasy with the regime sending money to a genocidal regime in a distant place. Economic tremors of the ongoing low-intensity regional war are also having effect on other U.S. surrogates in the region. For Machiavellian reasons, the PGCC regimes are unlikely to increase their economic activities with Israel soon. This means that whatever additional revenue the Zionist regime and the regimes trading with it were counting on because of normalization will not materialize. As pro-U.S. dictatorships clearly demonstrate their inability to stand up to Zionist Israel, an already existing divide between Western-backed autocracies and their populations is growing at a faster pace. This means that places like Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, and Morocco are likely to experience some form of political instability as the war on Palestine continues. Naturally, these places will be less attractive for business purposes. While this may look simply like an economic problem of the listed countries, the regimes in those countries are Israel's and America's puppets. Economic problems leading to unrest there will chip away at Israeli and American influence. Perhaps the most underestimated impact on the Zionist regime and the overall global economy are the actions of Yemen against Israeli-affiliated ships sailing through the Red Sea. While in econometric terms, Yemen's actions might appear minor, the overall impact is quite significant. In economics, perception often shapes reality. Israeli regime companies engaged in global trade in West Asia via the region's leading shipping routes will be seen as greater liability and a bigger risk to insurance firms. This will undoubtedly increase the cost for many Israeli transactions. The regional dimension of the war is on the path towards escalation. Western enablers of Israel are showing that they are unable to restrain the Zionist warmongers. Once the Lebanese front escalates, which is only a matter of time, economic pain will grow for Israel and its enablers. Also, according to Press TV, a group of about 300 senior Israeli economists wrote to the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and its extremist finance minister Bezalel Smotrich, harshly criticizing them for their detachment from the looming disaster. They warned in the letter, "You do not understand the magnitude of the economic crisis that Israel's economy is facing." They urged Netanyahu and Smotrich to come to your senses and immediately halt all non-essential expenditure items in the budget in order to cope with the looming economic crisis. Technology and tourism are the main growth drivers of the Zionist regime's almost $500 billion economy. Both sectors are the worst hit by the conflict. The tech industry accounts for 18% of Israel's GDP and half of all exports. According to an Israeli survey, about 70% of tech firms and startups are already facing disruptions in their operations as a chunk of their employees have reported for reserve duty. The survey said the initial disruption has been so severe that only 12% of Israeli manufacturers were at full-scale production after weeks of war. Most cited staff shortages as their biggest problem. The Labor Ministry says 764,000 Israelis, or 18% of the workforce, are not working after being called up for reserve duty, evacuated from their towns, or forced by school closures. Meanwhile, more than 126,000 Israelis from the north and south of the occupied territories have been relocated amid the ongoing exchange of fire. Many companies, from builders to restaurants, have also shut, and other retail firms have furloughed their employees. In the construction sector, which is heavily reliant on 80,000 Palestinians living in the West Bank, many workers are missing. This means the Israeli regime is on course to lose a significant chunk of its tax income from real estate and see a new price surge in the housing market, which is already among the most expensive in Europe and West Asia. The financial toll is already stacking up. The shekel, currently at its lowest value since 2012, is heading for its worst yearly performance this century. Meanwhile, Israeli stocks are the world's worst performance since the war began. And by all indications, the crisis is going to leave long-lasting scars across the Zionist regime's economy, from which it might never recover given the emotional and psychological jolt that the entity has suffered.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. We'll be right back.
Zionist Israeli entity intensified its aggression on Gaza while keeping one eye on Hezbollah in Lebanon and the other on the West Bank, primarily due to its strategic proximity. Neither the entity nor the United States of America foresaw that Yemen, which has been at war for years without a practical resolution, would turn into a new front. In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new stage of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear evolution in the history of resistance post-October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Christians and Christianity are under attack in Gaza and Palestine more generally. Zionist ideology is not just anti-Muslim, it is anti-Christian too. What is the common factor that links Muslims and Christians in Palestine? They're Palestinian. So it's no surprise that the Zionists are making sure to destroy churches as well as mosques. On October the 19th, Israel bombed the Church of St. Porphyrius, Gaza's oldest, killing at least 18 people. The church is said to be the third oldest Christian church in the world, with the current building having been constructed by the Crusaders in the 1150s or 1160s. A church was built on the site as early as 425 AD. 2 days earlier, an explosion at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, an Anglican institution located a few blocks away, killed and injured hundreds, according to Palestinian health authorities. The evidence is beginning to mount that the attacks on specifically Christian targets are themselves a specific genocide contained within the larger genocide aimed at Muslims and indeed all Palestinians. On December 16th, the Zionists directly targeted a Christian convent. An Israeli army sniper assassinated two Christian women, Nahed and her daughter Samar, inside the parish of the Holy Family in Gaza on Saturday, said the Latin Patriarchate's media office. One of the women fell while trying to rescue the other. Seven others were injured while attempting to help. Gunfire was directed at them inside the walls of the monastery, and there was no resistance in the area, it added. An Israeli artillery vehicle also targeted the Monastery of the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Gaza City, which shelters more than 54 disabled individuals within the church walls. The Zionist attack also destroyed the fuel tank, the power generator, and the solar panels, in addition to extensive damage that rendered the place unsuitable for habitation or providing care for people with disabilities. On January the 26th this year, a mob of Israeli settlers attacked an Armenian bar in the Christian quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, shouting, "Death to Arabs, death to Christians." At the beginning of October, a video emerged of ultra-Orthodox settlers in Al-Quds spitting on Christian pilgrims. Armed and violent settlers are also in the process of attempting to liquidate the Armenian quarter in Al-Quds, and with it, the wider Christian presence, which has been there continuously since the 4th century. Only 800 to 1,000 Christians are believed to still live in Gaza, constituting the oldest Christian community in the world, dating back to the 1st century.
This year, Christmas celebrations are cancelled in Bethlehem, and for obvious reasons. It's impossible to celebrate while our people in Gaza are going through a genocide.
It's no wonder the church in Palestine has cancelled Christmas.
Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe, it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than half a million people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief, they were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
This is a firm response to Israel's genocide and aggression against Palestinians. It has been about 2.5 months since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Muslim countries missed no chance to deplore the Israeli crimes verbally, but there were few, including Yemen, that firmly stood in solidarity with defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. After carrying out drone and missile strikes on Israeli targets, Yemen's armed forces have now been targeting Israel-bound vessels in waters around their country. The army has time and again stated it would stop its operations if Israel stops its aggression and ends its blockade on Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have also refuted claims about targeting ships moving toward other destinations. All vessels except Israel-bound ones can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. As usual, Israel's main backer, the U.S., has been trying to reverse the impact of the Yemeni operations by announcing the formation of a maritime coalition under the pretext that it would protect the transit in the Red Sea. But Washington's main goal is to protect Israel's interest. However, Yemen's Ansarullah has issued strong warning to the U.S. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a senior Ansarullah official, says the newly formed coalition will get a painful response if it violates the sovereignty of the Arab country. But how significant the Yemeni operations in the Red Sea are? In recent weeks, Yemeni naval forces have targeted several vessels sailing through the Red Sea toward Israel. Their primary goal has been to exert economic pressure on Tel Aviv, and they have been rather successful. Several major companies have suspended their shipments to and from Israel in the wake of Yemen's operations in the Red Sea. This has dealt a heavy blow to Israel's economy, with the latest reports indicating that the port of Eilat is hardly hit as the result of this disruption.
The non-arrival of ships to Eilat means that there is no income for the port, while the fixed expenses for its maintenance and operation remain the same, and we have a substantial negative flow.
The almost complete halt to the arrival of ships to Eilat has led to an 80% fall in the port's profits. This is while reports say that Egypt's Suez Canal has seen no harm to its maritime activities during Yemen's operations against Israel-bound ships. The Red Sea is a strategic trade route connecting Asia to Europe through the Suez Canal. About 12% of global trade passes through the Red Sea, including 30% of global container traffic. The disruptions in this area have had a direct impact on global economy. Now, cargo ships traveling from Asia to Europe have to sail around the African continent. This has increased the transit time and led to higher freight rates and delays. Also, shipping insurance costs have jumped by tens of thousands of dollars a day, and oil prices have gone up as well. To sum up, the international community has been unable to stop the Israeli crimes against Palestinians through political means. However, it seems Yemenis have employed a successful tactic to pressurize Israel.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Failing to achieve their goals in Gaza, the Zionist regime forces are punishing Palestinian civilians through systematic humiliation and subjecting them to degrading and sadistic treatment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East iWrote, since the onset of the Zionist regime's colonization of Palestine in 1948, innumerable visual records, photographs, and televised footage have documented wide-scale, disproportionate violence marked by humiliation and inhumane conduct by the Zionist regime military against unarmed Palestinian civilians. Notably, in many cases, the victims were defenseless children, women, and the elderly, and those with disabilities. On October 8, the Zionist regime's government launched a major military assault on Gaza, declaring its objectives as liberating the Israeli captives and dismantling the resistance movement Hamas, although several leaders, from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to War Minister Yoav Gallant, made clear their genocidal intent. 2 months later, with more than 20,000 Palestinians killed, it appears that the Zionist regime's government is failing to achieve its goals. The shocking level of carnage and destruction has triggered massive protests worldwide and international condemnations of the Zionist regime's genocidal war. The staggering death toll, particularly of children, attacks on the occupied West Bank, and wanton violations of international law, including the targeting of hospitals and placing a siege on food, water, and fuel, have raised questions about the intended outcome of the Zionist regime's war against Palestinians. This is coupled with internal pressure by the families of hostages and the broader Israeli regime public on the government to actively pursue their release. In light of mounting domestic and international pressure, the Zionist regime's government has been working to craft a narrative to justify the extreme violence it continues to inflict on more than 2.3 million residents in the Gaza Strip in the name of fighting the threat of Hamas. Historically, there have been numerous instances of militaries punishing civilian populations and subjecting them to sadistic and degrading treatment after failing to attain their political or military objectives. In response to global calls to halt its deliberate targeting of civilian infrastructure, the Zionist regime's government continues to desperately establish the purported military presence of Palestinian armed factions within major hospitals across the Strip. This effort materialized in an intense aerial and artillery shelling campaign on hospitals, including Gaza's main medical complex of Ash-Shifa. The attacks, targeting patients and displaced individuals within hospitals, extended to the detention, mistreatment, and exploitation of doctors as human shields. In a disturbing turn of events, the Zionist regime troops blocked medical staff from retrieving the bodies of victims from hospital courtyards, leaving them exposed to animals for an extended period. In other incidents, eyewitnesses testified to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor that the Zionist regime troops assaulted and humiliated Palestinian civilians using the designated safe corridor to evacuate Gaza City and the northern Gaza Strip, according to this group. One eyewitness account stated that an Israeli regime troop ordered a Palestinian man to strip while awaiting checkpoint approval. When another Palestinian questioned the troop's actions, he was fatally shot in the head with onlookers, including his family, barred from providing assistance or recovering his body. In a distressing series of events, accounts emerged of the Zionist regime troops subjecting displaced women to degrading treatment and humiliation in the designated safe corridor. Reportedly, two displaced women were ordered at gunpoint to undress in front of hundreds of onlookers before being permitted to redress and continue their journey southward. Additionally, in the northern Gaza Strip, a woman who was 5 months pregnant recounted an incident where an Israeli regime officer ordered her to take her clothes off and threatened her with rape if she did not comply. More recently, circulating video footage purportedly recorded by the Zionist regime military depicts numerous Palestinian men abducted and humiliated in the northern Gaza Strip. The men were predominantly displaced individuals seeking refuge in residential buildings and UNRWA-run schools amid the Zionist regime's bombardment. They were shown shirtless and stripped down to their underwear, with their hands raised behind their heads. The Zionist regime forces had lined them up on the street and taken photos and videos of them. The videos were shared widely by Zionist media outlets and troops, who have disseminated dozens of videos and pictures on their social media accounts, particularly since the ground invasion. In videos posted on TikTok and Instagram, they openly mock Palestinians as they celebrate the invasion of their neighborhoods and beaches. In other scenes of victory, they planted Israeli regime flags on vital facilities and headquarters, residential buildings and courthouses and universities. Contrary to the initial Israeli regime narrative locating the mass detention campaign in the Shajaya neighborhood in the east of Gaza City and in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, subsequent revelations disclosed that the incident took place in Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's forces said those abducted were members of Palestinian armed factions. However, testimonies of eyewitnesses and members of the abductees' families collected by Euromed Human Rights Monitor's team on the ground and other organizations and journalists confirmed that they were unarmed civilians, including teachers at the UNRWA-run schools, who are typically security checked multiple times before and during their work period with the United Nations, journalists, and university students. The initial disinformation, later corrected, is not only a result of the Zionist regime's attempt to demonize Gaza residents, but is also indicative of a persistent endeavor to present an image of victory to its citizens and, most importantly, to its Western allies. It aims to provide supposed proof that its bloody military campaign, which has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians and displaced hundreds of thousands more, was in fact meant to subjugate all Palestinians into subordination and not simply eradicate the resistance movement Hamas. Violence within settler colonialism is a peculiar breed. This brand of violence goes beyond mere dominance or cultural erasure. It aspires to region over and obliterate not just communities, but the very essence of individual psyches. At its core, it seeks to humiliate. The Zionist regime employs a systematic strategy of humiliation to psychologically impact and break down Palestinian individuals and communities. The objective is to instill feelings of shame and degradation and potentially induce enduring psychological effects that erode Palestinian steadfastness and resistance. Despite being a consistently applied policy for the past 7 decades, it has not succeeded in deterring the Palestinian population. An essential question for the Zionist regime is to reflect on the implications of internalizing and normalizing practices that involve humiliating fellow humans and taking pride in such actions. This systematic violation of human dignity and justice demands a critical examination of its impact on Israeli Zionist societal norms and values. The fabricated regime of Israel and its Western backers like to compare its genocide in Gaza to the Allied campaign in Dresden. But this is a false narrative. Unlike the Allies, who did not attempt to humiliate the people of Dresden, the Zionist regime's violence, particularly in its destructive power and evident desire to humiliate, is akin to the atrocities and humiliation witnessed during other parts of the world.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. This revolution was able to remove the dependent, corrupt system that was ruling the country and establish a new system and a new voice in its place, the Islamic Republic. Republic means democracy. Islamic means religion. Religious democracy was a new term in the world. We have had religious governments throughout history, but there was no talk of democracy in them. We have had democratic governments, real or fictitious, but there was no talk of religion in them. Never before had there been a government or a system in which religion and this world and the hereafter, and people and God were all involved and were the builders of it.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
But such a thing happened, and they wanted to crush it, overcome it, and eliminate the Islamic Republic. This was their target. And this has remained their target up until today. They come up with all different types of excuses. But as to those who are against the Islamic Republic, are opposing it, and are hostile toward it, their problem is with the Islamic Republic. Other marginal issues are of less importance. This is their main issue, and it was back then as well. Of course, there was a wicked, greedy person such as Saddam in the midst of this who was far removed from any aspect of human decency. He had another goal as well, which was to destroy the Islamic Republic, to invade and assault the country's territorial integrity, to take the oil-rich regions of the country, and to divide the country. These were his goals. But the other parties didn't care much about these things. Their main concern was that the Islamic Republic. There is a big difference between a war that takes place with the aim of changing a part of the border between two countries and a war that takes place to destroy the thing that constitutes the identity of a nation.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Marching for Our Martyrs and Palestine was the name of the rally organized by the IHH, a humanitarian relief foundation in